Hello, everyone. Welcome to It's Hot in Here,
CBNFM Ann Arbor, 88.3. And this is your mixed talk and environmental news show coming at you from Ann Arbor, Michigan, from the School of Natural Resources and Environment. It's Becca and Rebecca and Pearl on the mic today with a couple of fantastic guests in studio. And we've got Danya, Andrea, and Ethan in the studio today, doing our tech work for us. We're going to be talking today about some pretty heavy topics. Becca, why don't you tell us about what's on the docket?
Yeah, so today we've got an excellent show about environmental toxicology and the epidemic of birth defects that are happening in Iraq And we've got in the studio with us some wonderful guests, the first of which is Sam Molnar. He is a master's student at the University of Michigan.
Environmental justice,
talking about those public health implications. And we will soon have joining us Dr. Mozgan Sababiesvahani, who will be talking a little bit about her work. But I'd like to start with an old feature from It's Hot in Here. And that feature is What's in Season.
Oh, What's in Season. Back in the day on this show, which many of you know, was founded back in 2008 by SNRE students Jennifer Johnson and Sarah Swick. Sarah Swick, who's now the Michigan reporter, Detroit reporter for Michigan Radio. They had a feature called What's in Season. They used to play that little song, you know, it's the time of the season. And then talk about what is in the farmers markets and the supermarkets and what's out there. So we can't have a show about medicine and health and human bodies without first paying a little homage to the harvest moment. We just finished a harvest festival, I think, right, Pearl, at SNRE?
And yes, there was a harvest festival last Sunday, and it was really cool. It happened in Campus Farm, where the people who organized it, including Becca, did a great job of linking local food with those fun activities and bring people together to enjoy the harvest and have that connection with local food and nature. Mm-hmm.
That is fantastic. I know the Solar Farms Festival or the Solar Farms Tour was going on last weekend, too. So there's a lot going on in the countryside around us right now. And what are we seeing? What are we seeing in our farmers markets and our supermarkets, people? What's out there? What's ripe? What's happening? I know my kale is finally getting tasty in my garden beds in front of my yard because that first frost gives it a little bit nuttier flavor. So the kale chips and the shredded kale, delicious right now.
We got plenty of pumpkins and squash, and actually my garden is still producing tomatoes. It's a little late in the season,
wow,
but I've still got tomatoes, which I'm working with. How about you, Sam?
Well, I bought some really tasty tomatoes a few days ago, and I have been getting some great squash out of the Eastern Market in Detroit. And the fresh herbs are what I love the most because, you know, you add that parsley to your dish and it just makes it explode with flavor.
Fantastic. Now, I have to say, Sam was kind of going on a little about a secret vegan squash soup recipe earlier, and I'm going to just call you out on air. Live. What's the secret, Sam?
Oh, boy. Well, I myself am not a vegan, but I was at my Aunt Kim's house on Sunday night, and she was giving away leftovers, and she had these huge roasted spaghetti squash. And she said, does anyone want these? And everyone said, nah, what am I going to do with cold squash? And I said, well, I'll take those. I could make soup with that. And I'm not a vegan, but my girlfriend Kim Siegel is, shout out to her. And I thought I would try and make a squash soup. So the other morning, I woke up extra early to do some homework and decided to procrastinate a bit, and I made some soup. And so what you do is you take your roasted squash and some onions, and you pour them in a pot with some olive oil, and you let them roast and get a little brown in there and add some salt.
Kind of caramelize a little, get a little sweetness in those onions.
Yeah, and if you really want to add some sweetness, what you can do is chop up an apple and throw it in, and you get the sugar in there.
Nice.
And so you take all that, and you let it roast together with some cinnamon and some paprika. And then you pour your water on top, and you let it boil over, and you let it cook for about half an hour. I let it cook for an hour, let all those flavors get in. And at the very end, you take some nice, thick coconut milk and you pour it in, about half a can.
That's the secret.
Wow.
Coconut milk.
Not local.
That's a good point. And actually, I have to say, I was going to try to trump you with a recipe that comes out of this brand new restaurant on Liberty Street, Taste. Local ingredients, global cuisine. And they do a squash soup that I think is also vegan, and it's made with a lemon olive oil and butternut squash. And then they finish it with, get this, not local, a cashew mascarpone.
Mm.
It's like a creamy, nutty, and they drop it right into the soup. And then you have the sharp lemon and the buttery cashews. It's awesome. So squash soup it up, people. That's what's in season. And we've just given you two different ways to enjoy it here on It's Hot in Here. But time is wasting. We've got to get on to conversations about war and what it's good for. So I think what we're going to do at this point, as we bring our guests into the studio to talk to us about these issues around the world, West Africa, Iraq, and the ways that U.S. interventions in a military mode might have impacts for the medical health of many, many people worldwide, as well as for our own men and women in uniform. We want to talk about that, but first we're going to hear a tune right out of Motown, not too far from Eastern Market. It's called War, What Is It Good For? So let's get that queued up, hear a little music, and then we'll come back for a slightly deeper discussion. Thank you for listening. Welcome back to It's Hot in Here, our mixed environmental talk show tunes and grooves and news for a green planet. This is Rebecca Harden with Becca and Pearl and Sam Molnar out of the School of Natural Resources and Environment. And that was Edwin Starr singing War, What Is It Good For? Now, some of you may have heard that tune. Frankie Goes to Hollywood recorded it when I was younger. Bruce Springsteen did it and really rocked it. It's a song that doesn't go away, but it started out right here in Detroit. Motown tune originally written and performed by the Temptations, but then the studios decided that it needed to be an angrier, more vehement protest song, and it did go on to become one of the most famous, popular, and widely recorded protest songs against war ever recorded. So you can find that on video on YouTube. We'll try to post that on our blog. Many of you know that we do blog after these shows at www.hotinhere.us. You can find more information about the tunes we play and the talk we do by just logging on to our archive and our website. Learn more about all of us. So, Warr, what is it good for? Becca, you were at this talk, and Sam and Pearl, maybe some of you also. What has been going on this campus this week?
So, what's been going on is a wonderful lecture by our guest, Dr. Mozgan Sabo-Biasfahani, who I'd like to introduce now.
Thank you, Becca.
Thank you for being here today. It's been wonderful, and the lecture was great. And I'd also like to introduce our other guest, who's been talking a little bit about his wonderful squash soup, Dr. Sam Molnar. We were both in attendance at this lecture, and it was a wonderful experience to see how Warr isn't just an immediate experience. It's not just we think of it as so quick and so.
Violent in the moment,
yeah,
right? It's traumatic and it's immediate.
Mm-hmm. Violent in the moment. But what was talked about at this lecture was some of the long-term impacts of Warr. And that's what Dr. Sabo-Biasfahani was there to talk about. She is a public health advocate and is interested in this research. She also did her postdoc at University of Michigan. So she is familiar with Ann Arbor, and it was a wonderful talk.
Thank you so much.
And we had actually two speakers, right? Dr. Al-Sabak, also here from Iraq. You actually, Mozgan, you were very instrumental, I think, in bringing him all the way to the United States. And if I'm not mistaken, the two of you are heading out of here at 6 a.m. tomorrow on a whirlwind tour. Is that correct?
It's true. We're going to be on 7 different campuses across the U.S., mostly in the East Coast. And it's going to be a long journey, but worth every moment of it.
So you're headed to Princeton and Columbia and Harvard, all the way out to Seattle, University of Washington.
Yes, absolutely. And all really top School of Public Health receptions. It's going to be hopefully very helpful to us in terms of discussing our research and our findings, and also developing collaborations, and hopefully expanding the whole idea that we need to be very aware of what bombings and military activity does in the long run to the public in areas that are affected by it.
That sounds really important, and I know that you yourself were actually a scholar in our public health school here at the University of Michigan, correct? You did a postdoctoral fellowship here years
ago? Yes, I worked with Dr. Padmanabhan. She's a pediatric endocrinologist, and at that time, we were looking at effects of endocrine disruptors on a female reproductive system. And, of course, we found striking results, and we published it, and eventually I ended up going back to Iran, and I was teaching toxicology at the Board University with Iraq. And our campus was quite affected by the bombings of Basra. And so that's how I got interested in what may be happening in terms of pollution and reproductive health in Iraq.
You had colleagues on your campus who you felt were having health problems that crossed those borders, and
we had quite a small campus. However, on that semester in 2004, fall of 2004, three of my students had miscarriages. Now, miscarriages could be a result of stress, but at the same time, Iran receives quite a bit of pollution from Iraq. And it's not inconceivable that we did receive some of the major, air pollutants.
Well, there's no better example of the way that medical risks cross borders than what's currently happening with Ebola in West Africa. And it is also a great example of the ways in which responses to medical risk and epidemiological risk are bound up with the geopolitics of militarization in our world right now, to see very, very brave U.S. troops going on the ground in Liberia. And I would salute, those men and women. I heard some of their voices on NPR this morning, going in with some trepidation, but some real commitment to try to turn that around. But in an environment where the U.S. is also very nervous about the expansion of independent militias and Islamist movements in those parts of West Africa. So there's really a kind of sense, I think, of the indissociability these days of epidemiological risk and sort of geopolitical and military affairs. I think that's a fascinating place for us to be, and a troubling one.
Yeah. What I can say is that specifically about the Middle East, it's the presence of U.S. Military is associated so strongly with so much violence that people cannot see that they can do anything good. And I think truly the best way to strengthen civil society, for example, in Iraq, is to withdraw military forces and allow the civil society to grow and strengthen itself, because that's the only way you can really push back this militia and things and groups that are outgrowth of actual military intervention.
And yet that's not necessarily the direction we're going at all, is it?
No.
So it becomes very important to look back then at these legacies of longer-term damage from previous generations of U.S. intervention in that region.
Absolutely.
How did you feel the talk went? I know, Sam, you were also in the room at the talk the other day. Did you feel like you had a sense of student response to some of the... Because if I recall, and I would like to say that briefly, you know, I'm sorry that your colleague from Iraq is not with us in studio today. Our listeners might be interested to know that... he was called away quite unexpectedly this morning by a driver taking him to the consulate, the Iraqi consulate in Detroit, Southfield, Michigan. And we all had some moments of wondering what that might be about and whether it was a cause for any alarm or rather some celebration of the fact that, which turns out to be the case, that the consulate is impressed and interested that these conversations are happening and that they're engaging scientists and students at high levels. I think it's a real commendation of your work these years. But he can't, for that reason, all of a sudden make it to the studio today. So, Sam, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what he said in that room at the SNRE just this week.
Sure. I thought the talk did an incredible job of bringing the war home, which is something that we have a hard time with, I think, in the wars that we've experienced over the past decade, is really seeing the effects of those. We see numbers and we hear about deaths that happen, but we don't understand the long-term effects of these wars on the places where they happen. And to see the images of these birth defects was quite alarming. And I think I wasn't alone in the audience when I had to look away from some of the images. And it helps to remind you that the impacts of the decisions that our government makes here have really long-term effects. Not just on people who are living, but people who will be born in the future.
So I think on that note, it might make sense to cut back to some music that will capture a little bit of the context of the home out of which our guests are coming today. We have an artist, Nassim Shama. And this is a musician out of a city on the Tigris River, actually, who started studying the oud at the age of 12 in Baghdad. And he plays this kind of emotive style compositions in really beautiful tones to major audiences across the Middle East and indeed the world. So these stirring musical reflections might make way to for us to think a little bit about the connections between our U.S. experiences of these events and those on the ground in these areas. Let's hear a little more music, and then we'll be right back on the mic. It's hot in here. Thank you. Welcome back to It's Hot in Here, your mixed show for news and grooves, environmental hope, optimism, and challenges on air live every Friday, 12 to 1, here at WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor, 88.3, or WCBN.org on your internet. I know that a lot of our listeners are streaming us from their computers, and we would like to give a shout out to all our streamers today. Sam Molnar, a student interested in environmental justice at our School of Natural Resources and Environment, was just filling us in on a really remarkable talk that happened earlier this week at our school. It was a talk that was by our studio guest, Mushgan, a public health advocate and activist based now in Ann Arbor, whose career has spanned the Middle East and North America, but also by Dr. Al Sabak, unable to be with us today in studio, who did a presentation about rates of birth defects and abnormalities in fetuses and children in Iraq and what's happening with those rates. I think, Pearl, you were saying that those images were very powerful.
Yeah. Dr. Al Sabak, in his presentation, he has present a series of pictures about newborn babies who have the birth defect, which I think is a very visualized way for us to feel what are the effects are, rather than just looking at data and numbers. And also, this really brought us to think about the cross-generation effect of the war.
And Sam talked about that as a kind of bringing things home to us and helping us create connections with the experience of families who are struggling under these burdens. I wonder, Sam, what do you know about those rates, or what do any of us know about what's actually the trend there? We don't want to sideline the data altogether. What do the numbers look like?
Well, from Dr. Al-Sabak's talk, we saw that in 1995, actually, Dr. Al-Sabak did something really great, which was he just sort of had an interest in the 90s on what the level of birth defects was at the hospital he works at. And so he happened to take a baseline, which made all of this research possible. And in 1995, they had 1.37 birth defects per 1,000 births. And in 2003, it went up to 23 birth defects per 1,000, and then at the maximum height of the war, what was the number?
It was 48 per 1,000 live births. So in 2008, they had the highest numbers. I think last year he had just compiled his data, and it looks like in 2013, it was 37 per 1,000 live births, which are quite significantly higher than what they saw in 1994.
And quite alarming, actually.
Yes.
I was wondering about the predicament of the doctor in this situation, right? I mean, he spoke a little bit. In fact, he showed an image of an ultrasound, did he not? Mm-hmm. And why? What was he saying about that?
Well, basically, one of his major concerns are that he's unable to tell his patients whether a child is malformed or not. So sonography would allow him to detect that very clearly. But the laws right now prohibits him from sharing that information with the parents, which makes his job very difficult. So that was basically the purpose of his slide on the sonography slide. He was trying to say that he's pressed for that. He doesn't know how to deal with it. He doesn't know what to say to the parents.
And this is something that happens differently in Iran, for example?
In Iran, it is different because the doctors are allowed to tell you if there's a malformation, and the parents can decide whether or not they want to keep the child or abort the fetus. So while there is indications that the birth defects may be going up slightly in the south of Iran, neighboring Iraq, but you don't actually see that rise in numbers because the births are terminated quite early on.
That would be a very difficult situation as a medical caregiver to have that enforced barrier of communication between you and your clients, your patients. I think especially if you were feeling the tension of that being in their best interest to have the knowledge. Yes. And it's really difficult. I mean, I don't know whether there are any possibilities for shifts in any mm-hmm. of these policies or whether these things seem fairly set in stone mm-hmm. at the moment.
Well, I think the most important thing we can try to push for right now is large-scale monitoring of the environment in Basra and especially like other cities like Fallujah Syria and Mosul and places where there are really large increases in birth defects. These environmental monitoring would allow us to see if there is an actual, there are hot spots where this pollution is getting out and getting into the public, and then it can be cleaned up to prevent it. In terms of changing the laws in Iraq, I think it will be probably very difficult to do. So our best bet would be to go for prevention, which is cleanup.
I wonder if there are other communities of educators mm-hmm. or scientists or medical care providers who constitute a voice in all of this in the ways that I know you're pushing and encouraging U.S. knowledge mm-hmm. communities to do. I mean, I realize that there is some sense in which none of these things will change mm-hmm. unless there is some kind of outcry from medical care professionals who see these trends and they mm-hmm. see the consequences and causes, not just of the communications policies, but of the mm-hmm. militarization itself.
Absolutely true. We were talking about this earlier, and that what is happening in Iraq did not have to happen at all, because in terms of historic data, we are well aware of what happens after large-scale military interventions such as the one that happened in Iraq. We've seen the results of that in places like Korea, like Vietnam, like Philippines, where places where still to this day people are affected, births are affected by the pollution that was left with the U.S. military bases. In Vietnam, I think the situation is quite bad in terms of public exposure to pollutants that have been released from various bases. And I think our job is, in terms of this kind of stuff, is prevention. We need to start talking with schools of public health, think about what is our role as people who are involved in global public health. How can we act to stop these kinds of episodes from happening again? I feel large-scale public discussions of things like this would be extremely beneficial. It will get the public involved in talking. It will get the schools of public health involved in talking with the public, and it will create an atmosphere where we can do things differently next time.
I think that calls for a trio. The trio you're describing of academics, activists, civil society, I think reminds me a little bit that we have a trio queued up here in terms of our musical offerings for today. Le Trio Joubran, which is an Arabic oud trio playing traditional Palestinian music. And this trio that you're going to hear consists of these brothers, right? Samir and Wissam and Adnan Joubran. And they are originally, I think, from the city of Nazareth. Now dividing their time between Nazareth and Ramallah and Paris. So I think in the spirit of combined forces on any issue, we should play a little bit of that trio, and then we'll be back on the mic with more about trends and transcending despair on these issues for some engagement. Thanks.
Thank you.
WCVN-FM, it's hot in here, and we are back on the mic with our discussion today of the long-term trends in birth defects and deformities in families, children and families in Iraq, subsequent to military interventions by the U.S. and other powers, and thinking more broadly about the challenges of analyzing the consequences of war of combat, of military interventions, not just in the moment, but in the long term for landscapes, families, generations of people. I think we've had some shuffling in the studio, and Danya is on the mic with a question for our speaker based on her earlier comments.
Thanks for letting me squeeze in here. The conversation so far has been incredible, and I think one of the things that have stood out to me is just how little people know about this issue. And you were talking before about engaging people in a discussion, and I wanted you to talk a little bit more about what are the barriers that have kept people from engaging in this discussion in the past, and what you foresee, you know, the barriers will be in the future moving forward now that, you know, this research is really starting to come forward.
I tell you, in 2012, when we published our second paper, I spent a lot of time trying to get the information out. A lot of times, it's the media does not show a lot of interest in reporting things that might, you know, be not great. You know, people don't like to hear bad news, and they prefer to hear, you know, good news. However, we eventually were able to get enough reporters interested in the results of our research. I think a major obstacle is media disinterest. If we can overcome that, and I think we can if we get a lot of people who are in positions of scientific knowledge, for example, schools of public health, or people who are valued in their knowledge about the field, if we get them to get engaged in the discussion about this, we could probably break that barrier.
But Mushkan, I have a question about that, because, you know, you say the media didn't have any interest, but we always hear about newscasters saying, mm-hmm. if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Yeah.
And we constantly hear about mm-hmm. bad news mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. So what is different mm-hmm. about this story mm-hmm. that people don't know about it, or mm-hmm. the news media doesn't want to report it?
Well, I think I will tell you what a colleague told me a few years ago. He said that my research makes U.S. look bad. And I think that is one major factor. They feel like this is not good for U.S. image. But I think as public health researchers, as human rights activists, as people who want to see things done differently in the future, we can't worry about that. We have to worry about public health on the ground. And so that's how I feel about it.
So what practices are contributing to some of these effects? What, mm-hmm. as public health researchers, should people try to help mm-hmm. prevent mm-hmm. in this case?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think the best way I can see change coming is if public gets involved in discussing things, if public is first informed and then given a chance to get involved in the discussion, and also the scientific community. My hope in organizing this long tour with Dr. Al-Sabak is to get into scientific communities that are normally quite silent about things like this, talk to them, ask their opinion, get them to speak out, and see that in the future, things like this won't happen, and also promote more discussion around it. Because I know for a fact that a lot of people don't have any idea how, for example, military bases will continue to be a source of pollution for years to come. Nobody knows how or why. So these are the things that we need to be talking about.
Pearl, you had a question.
Yeah, talking about how the scientific community act. So I find it during the lecture, after Dr. Al-Sabak talked, mm-hmm. you came up mm-hmm. and proposed like the hopeful aspect,
yes.
like of how you take actions.
Yes.
What are some studies you have done? Mm-hmm. And do you want to talk a little bit about that?
And while we're waiting for your answer, I should mm-hmm. say, in the spirit of public discussion, that we do have phone lines open, as we often do on mm-hmm. this show. And mm-hmm. if anyone listening from our schools of medicine, public health, environment, from our international institute, from down the road in the Ann Arbor community, where you yourself may be living in the age of Ebola anxiety and thinking about these issues from wherever you're sitting, please give us a call, as you know you always can, at 734-763-3500. That's our DJ line, and we'll do our best to patch you in without losing you and put your voice into this conversation as well. That's what this show is all about, and we value our callers. Mm-hmm. Let's think about that question from Pearl about strategies for hope and the upside of these terrible, terrible tragedies.
Well, basically, our research has shown that the public in cities like Fallujah, Hawija, and Basra, they've been exposed to large amounts of lead, titanium, mercury, and magnesium. These are metals that are heavily used in weapons manufacturing. We know the public is contaminated, and we know that contamination with these kinds of metals, when a pregnant woman is exposed to these kinds of pollutants during her pregnancy, and when a young child is exposed to them as they're developing, it would have severe consequences for them. The issue here is like what do we do now? What we can do is large-scale environmental monitoring. It's very possible. We have the technology. And monitoring the pollutants in the environment, house dust, soil, water, you name it. We can sample these things and find out where exactly these pollutants are. One major thing we do already know is that there is over 500 U.S. military bases in Iraq right now. And these military bases are sites for maintenance of large weaponry, and for maintenance of these things you need things like lubricants and various chemicals, highly toxic chemicals, and they are used on these military bases. So another thing we could do is to make sure that they're not leaking into the environment, and that would really help us get a lot of these toxins out of the immediate public areas so that people can be saved.
Mushkan, can you also talk about some of the other sources of pollutants? I remember from your talk you gave a number about for every civilian killed in Iraq, there were 300,000 bullets expended for one civilian, and also about these open pit burns, which I had never heard about, and I'm sure the listeners would love to hear about.
The open air burn pits are a big. Anybody can Google them, and they will find out about what is happening since. A few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, thousands of Iraq war veterans, Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, have been reporting cancers and lung disease and things like that. And after a long fight, they managed to make the Department of Veterans Affairs to set up a registry, which means people who think that their lung disease or their cancer may have been due to exposure to burn pit emissions, they can sign up and be followed, and they will enjoy certain benefits in the future in terms of health. These burn pits that we're talking about, apparently, in order to manage the waste generated on U.S. military bases, they would throw them in these pits and simply burn them. Burning these waste, including electronics, computers, styrofoam, lots of these things, they would just burn it in these pits, and the emissions would be in the air. Apparently, they did this from 2003 to 2010, when use of these burn pits were called illegal, and they stopped it. I think Halliburton and a sister company called KBS were doing this practice, and it's stopped since. But emissions from these burn pits have caused a lot of health damage for American soldiers, and as well as it looks like to us from people who live in and around the area of these military bases.
You know, that kind of reminds me of a Ben Harper tune. Mm-hmm. It's called, what is it called? Both Sides of the Gun, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It kind of gets at that whole set of horrible Halliburton moments. And I think maybe we should listen to just a few seconds of it before we resume this conversation, folks. It's hot in here.
Than the war that can't be won. It's tension.
back with us on It's Hot in Here, your environmental talk and tunes show out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I am saying a hello to Ann Arbor and to the world, sitting in studio talking about the long-term effects of war, not only in terms of, say, chemical agents like Agent Orange. We all know the studies out of Vietnam. In fact, Mushkan, you were talking with us earlier about your sense of this research. Like, there's a lot of studies from a lot of conflicts now, right? The mm-hmm. Philippines, Vietnam. Yes. What are other places that are feeding into this field of science?
Basically, places where the United States has large military presence, military bases, these are all places where you end up with the toxic material in these bases that have a very good potential to get into the environment surrounding them. Vietnam is a very good example. There are three major airports that were taken over by the U.S. and then they used them as military bases. Da Nang is one. They are hoping to be able to clean it 40 years later. But during these past 40 years, thousands of Vietnamese were born in a very highly polluted environment. And the burden of birth defects and cancers in Vietnam is quite high on the public health system. So the idea is that how can we as public health advocates prevent these kinds of stuff from happening again? What has happened in Iraq should never have happened, given that we know the consequences of military intervention, consequences of it on public health. So we could have prevented it, and I hope to be able to prevent this from happening elsewhere.
But of course, potentially even beginning most visibly with Vietnam, but other subsequent conflicts, we've also watched the very terrain on which wars are fought shift from formal battlefields or even simply quote-unquote no-man's lands like forests mm-hmm. to neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods. Absolutely. I mean, war is no longer confined. And I guess, you know, I'm a Southerner, okay? I make sure my daughter knows how to shoot a .22. My husband, too. He's from India. But I'm like, okay, look, you know, you're in America now. You got to work this out. But when we do that, when I go back to the South and my uncles and cousins take us out to firing ranges outside of Georgia, outside of Atlanta, those are terrains that are demarcated and have been for decades for the firing of weapons at targets. And they really cannot be used for anything else anymore because there is so much lead yes. in the water on that land, and there is so much lead in the soil. And there's a sense in which, you know, we have the good fortune, right, to be able to demarcate spaces as dangerous spaces for those mm-hmm. kinds of activities and protect our children and our food and our residential spaces from that. And that basic ability, that basic right at some level, right, to protect oneself spatially from these risks mm-hmm. is not existing in
not
the places you're describing.
In fact, the last city from which we collected samples in Iraq, it's called Hawija. It's a very tiny town of 40,000 people. And in 2003, the small school, well, the largest school there is still small, was taken over by U.S. military, and it was converted into a military base. And what we see in Hawija right now is quite a large number of children born in Hawija are being born with neurodevelopmental disorders and things like cerebral palsy. And so the issue is in a little town that's 40,000 population, everywhere is close to the military base. So you are exposed to those emissions from burn pits that burnt for 7 straight years. And if a woman is pregnant at that time or if a fetus is developing at that time and they're being exposed to these really toxic fumes, there is no doubt that they will end up with severe consequences. So the idea is, yes, these things have come so close to your doorstep in places like Iraq, and there's no avoiding them. And this is quite harmful to public health.
I just want to highlight, Mushkan, one of the things you said that really sort of underlines the insanity of war, which is that the only school in this small town was turned into a military base, and the town lost its school, and it also gained this pollution. And I kind of want to turn that around, because I think a lot of our listeners might find this to be a pretty depressing and disempowering conversation. So what can academics, but also just everyday people, do to prevent these types of things from happening, and also to maybe amend for what has happened?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I don't know how to answer it, though. I think that I think that within our campuses, the important thing is for the students to think about how their research really feeds into the military system or military
industrial complex.
Thank you. I did. How does it happen? We know that U.S. is the top producer of weapon and distributor and seller and all that. I think each year upwards of 800, is it billion? I don't know. A lot, large amount of money goes into the military. And as a result, there is a lot of research money available at the Defense Department, and the research that's done for the Defense Department at the end, it ends up in harming public health. I mean, there is nothing else that happens but to develop more weapons, develop more ammunition that would really harm the public. So I would want the students to think about it. What is my research at this institution? And the universities are quite tightly bound in with the Department of Defense in terms of developing more advanced weapons and more advanced this and that. So I think one thing you can do as a student is to think about it. How is my research helping or harming public health?
That's Ulrich Beck, that basic insight about risk societies and the way that knowledge gets bound up with the engines of capital. And sometimes it's hard to pry that apart, especially mm-hmm. if you do feel, as a student or even as a researcher, somewhat dependent upon, you know, scarce resources. It's very tricky.
Absolutely.
And I think it does require partnerships, like you described earlier, across sectors and across even cultures. We have featured in this studio projects looking at the Atlas of Environmental Justice, which has been produced by a European Union program called Environmental Justice Organizations, Liability and Trade. And I think the global tools of monitoring and communicating across sites in which people are suffering environmental harm are on the cusp of really getting kind of revolutionized. And that's a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. I would also point to the fact that our current president of the World Bank, an institution which has not always only been known for its progressive and salutary policies, but which has sort of tried to address over the years, right, some of the downsides of big development and of you know, projects like hydroelectric dams. Our current president of the World Bank is Jim Kim, who is both a global health scholar and an anthropologist, and who has written a great deal on why succumbing to despair, in some cases around issues of drug-resistant tuberculosis in very poor populations, is not okay. No, he says, and has said in his work with Paul Farmer and others, these are forms of structural violence. They are forms of violence that are often silent or invisible, and they play out over long periods of time, and we can address them. We do not have to accept and take no for an answer. These people are too poor and too undereducated to take the complex medical regimen it would require. How do you know? Mm-hmm. Try, he says. And so I think that's an opportunity. He's long been someone who's talked about needing bodies, throwing one's own body at the problem, as I see you doing, embarking on this tour, right? Your own self, your own life. The scaling that up and thinking about what, you know, boots on the ground would look like if it were actually foot soldiers in the fight for better health and better education. How do we define those visions and begin to make them realities with our old imperfect institutions? And I think, you know, in classic hot in here form, I just want to lean on the fact that there are those of us really working hard and more effectively in those struggles. I also noticed, Sam, that you mentioned a pretty cool song about spacious skies. I know I'm sounding a little optimistic and patriotic and upbeat here, so I think it might be a good moment to hear a little Invincible, just to bring us back to, we started with some Motown right out of Detroit, some music about protest. Spacious skies, I don't know, what do you want to tell us about that song?
Sure. So Invincible is an artist from Ann Arbor, and she really sort of blurs the line between art and activism. And the song is about her emigration to America from Israel and her discovery that America is really not a great place.
She's an amazing female rapper and activist. I think it'd be fantastic if we hear a little bit of her right about now.
Yes. recollect when we first met. Friends of yours advised me come pursue you, hypnotized by your spell and smell. Surrounded by your perfume, I flew over. Know the laser runners with the steward. Yeah, I love was younger, newer than when we were honeymooners. Now my days were son of fewer. Nights in number, lunar eclipse, the glitter and glitz. Hate to admit, dismissed 100 rumors as imagination's figments. Spread like tumors, diagnosed malignant. Radiation patient hunting for the cure. You're so immature, unreliable, never liable. Blaming the entire globe and call them evildoers. But I'm sure there's no reparations for sweat and lost energy. Considered best comrades, became my worst enemy. Hurtful, abusive, blood curdles and oozes. Under the surface of epidermis, the purple is bruises. Truth is, you're gorgeous, but hunger for power gorgeous. With all forces contorts, a slim figure too enormous. Oh, beautiful, with your spacious skies. I wanna love you, but you hide behind a fake disguise. Oh, beautiful. Planned your birthday party for July 4th. I was disinvited, ride your high horse. For a black tie affair with your peers you can apply for. So beautiful, really wanna make this fit. Promise me to change your ways, keep on repeating the same mistakes and slip. Blow your candles, make a wish, erase the taste. I'm melting pots, blood on auction blocks. Now felons caught in cells, I seldom thought we 86 relationships. Obsolete like laser discs. Jealous thoughts, possessive, so on self-defensive, raising fists. You fail to hear the trail of tears and broken treaties. Border walls, we broke graffiti. Tag it like a toll, you'll go alone and greedy. Even though you know you need me, no pretending we codependent. You kill in my name, I get to blame your co-defendants. On much arrogance, it's an embarrassment. See a therapist for your paranoia of terrorism. While terrorizing, analyzing flaws in your character. Do you really love me, or just lust for power? America. Oh, beautiful, with your spacious skies. I wanna love you, but you hide behind a fake disguise. Oh, beautiful, your flirtatious eyes. Feeling for power in the taste between its waist and thighs. Oh, beautiful, with your spacious skies. I wanna love you, but you hide behind a fake disguise. Oh, beautiful, just don't waste my time.
Welcome back. It's hot in here, and it's a beautiful fall day in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We are your mixed environmental news and grooves show, and we're closing out today on a conversation that's been kind of hard to have at times about the cost for children and families, and indeed whole generations, of pollutants and toxins from war and from military interventions. We've been focused on the Middle East, and Mushkan, my guest in the studio today here with Becca and Sam Molnar and Pearl and Danya and Andrea, we've been thinking about not only why this is such a big problem, but also why there are ways for us to get smarter and better connected to each other and to engage it and to try to turn it around. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about why sometimes it's just enough to have the conversation, to keep talking about it in small, small ways, right? You don't have to necessarily run an entire effective campaign, advocacy campaign. You just need to keep the conversations alive, keep people interested, and fight that sense of sort of despair, like nothing can be done, right?
Absolutely. I feel that I've already succeeded big time because I've gotten this this information out into a very important campus in the United States. I know that a lot of people are listening. A lot of people did come to our talk. And I think once you get a large population of students thinking about things, it's a big impact. And I'm hoping our trips to all these other campuses across the U.S. will generate the same kind of environment, the same kind of available space through which we can reach a lot of minds. And a lot of minds knowing about things and thinking about things is already a win.
Yeah, that's the key. I think we have this view when we look back on history that social change happens during big marches or big events or big speeches or from our president. But the reality is that social change comes from these little conversations that can be sparked by bits of knowledge or small lectures. And that if we can focus on that, we can really build up to something that's a better world, especially in a time when we see our country going to war again in Syria.
That's absolutely right. And I want to just reiterate the fact that, you know, it's hard to talk about military processes and conflicts in relation to medicine without being reminded of the suffering of families in West Africa right now with the Ebola virus. And it helps us also think about why it is that something as contagious as Ebola really freaks us out. It's causing strikes at LaGuardia Airport. It's causing panic in Dallas, Texas. It's causing any number of fora online to be popping with all kinds of comments and questions here in the United States. You know, a birth defect, it's not contagious. It is widely, widely impacting schools and communities, but it is not something that might come into, quote, our own backyards, as New York op-eds have said about Ebola. And that sense of time, right? Because the truth of the matter is, as we've seen, for example, with HIV, is that even pathogens or biological challenges that work very slowly can bring, you know, community initiatives to their knees. If you lose expertise, if people lose their time and energy with that basic caregiving that they didn't have to do, that's that much hope and change that isn't happening as quickly. And so I wanted to just remind us that not only do things that bleed need to lead, but things that change capacities for communities to get smarter and better connected across the globe faster, those are real problems too. And we need to not forget them in an era of, ooh, infectious disease. And so I want to just go out with that sense of real engagement on all these fronts at once, and the connections between the suffering of families in West Africa and those in the Middle East and those here in the U.S. in cancer alleys and places in which risk is disproportionately high for certain kinds of health problems. We know where those places are here in our own country as well, and we need to be mindful of those connections. We got an outro song that sort of speaks to some of that hopeful going forwardness.
Yes, Betha? We do. I think it's important to focus on those opportunities to have small conversations and to move progress on this issue further. So with that, I would like to end our show today with a song, East to West, by Michael Franti. He's a gentleman from Oakland, California, who traveled to the Middle East. And this song is a little more hopeful. It leaves us on that positive note about his journeys and experiences. So that's where I'd like to transition us to. Thank you for having us today.
Thank you.
Hot and here we're up.
To the east, to the west. One to the sun, one to the morning, one to the one. One to the air and the freshness we breathe in. One to the force of the change in the seasons. One to the mother from which all things come. One to the daughters and one to the sons. One to the father who helps us believe that nothing's ever gonna harm you seeing. One to the soldier who walks city swamps in. One to the soldier who fights overseas in. One to the man who gets down on his knees and prays for guidance and protection, please. And to the east, to the west, to the north and south. To the east, to the west, one love, people never gonna stop. To the east, to the west, to the north and south. To the east, to the west, one love, people never gonna stop. One to the woman, one to the man. One to the culture from the time when it began. One to destruction, one to birth. One to the people who still fight for the earth. One to the people who suffer for the needs. And one to the rebels who love rocking to the beats. And one to the healer who fights a disease. And one to the Lorax who speaks for the trees. Cause no amount of money and no amount of man can bring back to life what's gone when it's done. And one to the people who rise with the sun. And one to the people who sleep when it's done. Cause to the east, to the west, to the north and south. To the east, to the west, one love, people never gonna stop. To the east, to the west, to the north and south. To the east, to the west, one love, people never gonna stop.
Whole thing seems upside down, the whole wide world keeps turning around. Whole thing seems upside down, wide world keeps turning around.
Life is too short to make just one decision. Music too large for just one station. Love is too big for just one nation. And God is too big for just one religion. One to the practice of being in the flow. And one to the tears of the things we let go. And one to the moment we live in right now. And one to the east, west, north and south. To the east, to the west. To the north and south. To the east, to the west. One love, people never gonna stop. To the east, to the west. To the north and south. To the east, to the west.